lasted for almost 25 years because I could not be complicit in all of this. And yet, governments are being complicit. We're closing our eyes. Now, we can talk a little bit more about what we've done with the Congress. There are some very, very strong signs of things happening. There are also huge obstacles that have to be overcome in order for anything substantive to really be implemented. But you know, I think as far as the opening statement, that'll suffice for the moment. So I'll turn it back over to Leila.
So you actually bring up a really good point and something I would like to address later, but I would like to open it to Q&A first. Obviously, Aung San Suu Kyi has actually had some pushback from certain organizations, one of them being the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, which just a few weeks ago they rescinded the Elie Wiesel Award, which is the highest award that they can give, because they said that you are actually being complicit in this. So I would like to get your thoughts later, but first, does anybody have some Q&A? Okay. Over there.
Yeah, would you say something about the... Sorry, this will help. McCain Cardin, is that going anywhere? Is it going anywhere in the House? Is it going anywhere in the world?
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee has actually passed it unanimously. And there was a great deal of support for doing something about that. Now, you know, in some cases, it imposes limited targeted sanctions on people in the military, and it provides for the opportunity to expand those sanctions. It provides for some sanctions against the gemstones trade. You know, Burma, Myanmar makes a great deal of money out of the sale of jade, rubies, etc. You know, there are the people again, and we Burma Task Force thinks that it should go a little bit further. The sanctions should be a little bit harsher. When we've had the various Rohingya Americans coming in here, unanimously they all say, you know, the only thing that stopped the military government from continuous repression was really effective full sanctions. So you know that's the only thing that's going to make them wake up. Now, the committee passed it. We have been told, and I won't say by whom, but by people in both the Congress and the Senate, that the main obstacle is what you saw on that screen when Suu Kyi was being feted by all of the different leadership in both the House and the Senate, that they are reluctant, or worse, to have anything done which is going to embarrass her and potentially undermine her position in the government. You know, I mean, you can make the argument. She is in a difficult situation. You know, she doesn't have full control of the government. The military controls 25%, and in order to get anything done, you have to have more than 75% of their parliament approving something. So the military still has a stranglehold on everything that goes on. We want to see her continuing to move down the path of democracy, but in my own view, personally, you know, there is a whole lot more she could be doing. You know, she risked all kinds of retribution, all kinds of penalty, everything. By speaking out, she has refused to speak out on this issue whatsoever. And as you said, they've taken away the Elie Wiesel Award. Apparently, there have been even conversations with the Norwegian government saying, you know, why don't you withdraw the Nobel Peace Prize? And we were told, apparently, that there is no mechanism for doing that. That they've apparently rethought about this, because they're so disappointed in her as well. But there is no mechanism that exists, because it's unprecedented. No one has ever been given the Nobel Peace Prize, and then having worldwide pressure saying it should be taken away. So there is going to be still obstacles in the Congress, in the leadership, but if we can get more and more people, representatives, congressmen, senators, etc., putting pressure on the leadership, you know, hopefully something might come out of this. You know, these bills are not radical; they're not extreme; they're very balanced. But you've got to get them through onto the floor and then through the whole approval process.
So I just wanted to clarify that the question was about Senate Bill 2060, correct?
Yeah.
Yes, which has been supported bipartisan senators. So just so that we're aware, would either of you guys like to comment on this, or should I go on to the next question?
I mean, yeah, my understanding is the same, that it's a problem of Senate leadership right now, and so that's where the pressure needs to be put on your senator to put pressure in turn on Senate leadership, because that's the stumbling block at the moment for the bill being brought to a vote.
Our senator is responsible.
What? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I live in Maryland, mm-hmm. And I'm sitting in the district that I work with. It's a Maryland senator who is in fact responsible for the bill.
Yeah, and Carton has been very, very vocal about it. He's been very supportive. Chris Van Hollen has also been supportive, not as vocally. You know, Carton was the ranking member, a member on the Foreign Relations Committee. He's now been replaced by, I forgot who. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there is still a great deal. You know, I'm sorry, I don't mean to monopolize. We did a Rohingya Advocacy Day at the end of February. And we started out thinking that we'll maybe have appointments with 20, 25 different people. But everybody that we approached and said, can we come and talk with you, said yes. So we had 55 different representatives, all of whom were very welcoming, very supportive, and said, what can we do to help? Well, pass the bill. So, well, we need your, and they would say, we need your help to get those bills passed.
Yeah, but what's the obstacle? We're not talking about the jewelry trade is not the equivalent of the NRA. I can't imagine they're terrified by the corner jeweler.
Well, of course, there's many players in stuff like this. I mean, it's not quite as simple as just, you know, one person or one organization. But I think for the sake of time, maybe we should move on to another question. Let's see.
My name is Salima. I work for the Voice of America. As Mithu well said, United States, United Nations, USA, and many other countries, Europe, are not playing good roles in this crisis. What about the Asian giant countries like India, China, and Russia? Could you please say something?
Is that addressed to somebody specific or just in general?
Either way.
I said the countries like...
No, I'm asking. Go ahead, Dr. Ling.
Okay, I'll start. So China, interestingly, has said that they would like to help, and they have said that they have a plan to help the government bring the refugees back and develop Rakhine State. So China has been extremely active in Myanmar. They have a lot of economic projects in the country, and they see this as an opportunity because the United States, maybe to some people's taste has not been critical enough, but from the Chinese perspective, this is an opening for them to return to Myanmar and to restore the relationship that they had with the Burmese government before, which was a very close relationship. And so they have tried to take advantage of this moment. India has not played a major role. India actually has 40,000 Rohingya refugees living in the country, and they've said that they're going to expel them, and that case is now in the Supreme Court. So it's not clear what's going to happen with those refugees, but they have not played any kind of a role in this inside the country, but we could say a negative role from outside the country. And I think, you know, that relates a little bit to the current government in power in India. I would say that it would be interesting to look at what kind of a positive role countries in Southeast Asia could play. So in 2008, when there was a humanitarian crisis after Cyclone Nargis in the country, and over 100,000 people were killed, over 2 million people were affected, the government said, we don't want anyone from outside to come in and help with this crisis. ASEAN and the UN were able to work out a relationship with the Burmese government to be able to go into areas and provide assistance. And that was seen as less threatening than at that time, you know, their fears of the West coming in and providing assistance. And so it would be interesting to think about, could there be some sort of role like that for countries in ASEAN to play in perhaps being less threatening to the Burmese government than the American government, and being able to provide assistance in Rakhine State and work with the government to try to adopt procedures that would allow the Rohingya to be able to come back and live safely and for development in Rakhine State for all people in Rakhine State.
A couple things on China in particular. There have been several public statements from Myanmar authorities indicating that they feel protected at the UN Security Council, and that is a direct reference to the fact that China and Russia, you know, are perceived as likely and have, in what's happened so far at the Security Council, to block or forestall more robust action in response. So there is a feeling amongst the authorities in Myanmar that there is a level of protection that they are receiving in terms of international pressure, and more, I would say, you know, tangible action. If we're thinking about things like targeted financial sanctions or an arms embargo, there is some amount of safety that they feel because of the role that China and Russia are playing, particularly on the Security Council. ASEAN, I think you know, you're absolutely right that it's important to engage them more, and there are specific countries in ASEAN who have been, I would say, more helpful on this in some of their statements and actions than others who have been far less helpful. I think the challenge is that in general ASEAN has a policy of kind of non-interference in the what are considered to be domestic issues in its countries. And so I don't think there's a lot of appetite to engage robustly on an issue that's considered to be a national or domestic issue in Myanmar, and Bangladesh is not part of ASEAN. And so you don't have that kind of regional aspect within the ASEAN community itself.
You know, I'll add just a couple of things. I've lived and worked in ASEAN for a long time. The Malaysians were the ones who really brought Burma into ASEAN and really pushed their fellows to accept it, even though they really didn't meet the qualifications. But, you know, as Matt said, their policy is not only non-interference, but consensus. They will not do anything unless there is a unanimity among all the members. Now, the Malaysian Prime Minister has publicly come out and vehemently criticized the Myanmar government. But you've got, and we can do a whole program on internal Malaysian politics that would cover the same thing. Malaysia is a majority Muslim country, but it's got its own political issues. Without going into all the depths of it, the Prime Minister has some significant issues of his own, and he's trying to play the card, the Islamic card. So he wants to show his voters that he is very much in support of what's happening to fellow Muslims. So they've been willing to violate a little bit some of the public policy of non-criticism of others, because this is a political move for him. They're also afraid that, you know, as they showed in the film, a lot of the people who left Myanmar in 2015 pitched up in Malaysia. They were all, that was one of the main destinations for all of those votes. So the Malaysians are very concerned. They do not want to be swamped again. Back in the late 70s, early 80s, Malaysia was the main destination for all of the Vietnamese boat people who came out. That was my first assignment in the Foreign Service, dealing with the Vietnamese boat refugees in Malaysia. They don't want to go through that again. The other thing, in China, my son lives in Hong Kong. He's the senior analyst for the Economist Intelligence Unit covering China. And we've talked about this. We have a line that's not being monitored. He's talked about, you know, I'm sure if any of you have heard of the Belt and Road Initiative, the Chinese see Myanmar as a convenient way to get through to warm water ports on the Indian Ocean. If you remember World War II history, if you remember the Burma Road, the Americans and the Brits were supplying the Chinese Nationalist Army through Burma, coming up through Burma, taking first trucks and then flying what they called going over the hump and C-47s to supply China. So the Chinese have a history of looking at this and saying this is an ideal way for us to get access to the rest of the world. So this is a critical part of it. They want stability. There are some who feel that some of the actions by the Myanmar government have been, you know, you try and get rid of the people in an area that is key to the Chinese development plans. Whether that's completely accurate, it's hard to say, but you know, that is something which a lot of people believe.
Okay, so we have, I think you raised your hand a couple times. Go ahead.
My name is Emma Derasa Dohoy. I'm from Nairobi, Kenya. So my main concern is we've been seeing how United Nations has been neglecting the crisis that is going on. But my main concern is the Security Council. I think, personally, I think it's the members are a bit outdated. We need new members from the Security Council to ensure that it's more effective. For example, India has the largest population and it's not involved in the decision making. No African country, not that because I'm from Africa, no, I'm just saying. Do you think we need to remove other member countries in the Security Council to ensure that the United Nations is more effective in matters like refugees and other things? Thank you.
Who would like to take that?
Okay. I can start.
Go ahead.
Going to what you said, I think on the last question, this is also an issue that probably necessitates several hours of discussion just on this alone in terms of what's happened in the Security Council over the last couple of years and what needs to happen going forward. I think what I would say is what we're seeing right now on Myanmar is part of a much broader systemic problem of the Security Council and its engagement on major human rights and humanitarian crises around the world. And because of the way the politics of the Security Council have shaken out, that, you know, again, kind of the lack of action on Myanmar is the same as the lack of action on Syria and Yemen and South Sudan before it, and plenty of other conflicts and major, again, humanitarian and human rights catastrophes that are happening. So yes, something needs to happen to shake up the dynamics with the Security Council. I'm not, to be frank, optimistic that that's likely to happen anytime soon, because those countries all have their reasons to protect the status quo. And so from my vantage point, the answer is more in thinking about other ways to come at these issues. So if the UN Security Council is never going to get its act together to impose sanctions on the military leadership of Myanmar, then we need to be exercising more pressure on the European Union and on others to impose those sorts of measures in a way that can still have real consequences, both symbolically and practically. Similar in terms of, you know, trying to get as many like-minded as possible on arms embargoes and stopping military-to-military engagement more generally. There is an arms embargo in the EU, though there are still dual-use equipment that's being sold. Australia continues to have military engagement with the Myanmar military. And so I think, again, kind of in the absence of an ability to move the UN Security Council, and I think we should all be realistic about the lack of likelihood of that happening, that doesn't mean we stop pushing. It means we find other avenues to try to achieve the same goals. We need a stronger, better Security Council, no question. But I don't see that happening in the near future, sadly.
Yeah, I mean, the Security Council was, you know, the purpose of the UN originally was to, and the Security Council specifically, was to resolve conflicts between states, not within states. And so that's something that the Security Council really still isn't very adept at handling, and the way it's structured, obviously, with the five members having the veto power. And if any one of those members is against it, you're not going to get anywhere, right? So that is a real sticking point. But I'm going to kind of take advantage of this moment to shift the discussion a little bit. I want to talk about Kofi Annan, who's the former Secretary General of the UN. And because of his stature, Aung San Suu Kyi had asked him to lead a commission to come up with recommendations for how to resolve the crisis in Rakhine State. And this is before the violence of the last year and a half happened. And so that commission, which included a few international people, including Kofi Annan, as well as some Muslims inside the country and Buddhist Burmans, Rakhine, inside the country, did come up with a series of recommendations for how to reestablish peace in Rakhine State, how to reestablish security, a pathway to citizenship for a Rohingya people, and also development in Rakhine State. And so the power of those personages, at least as At least at the time they were allowed to come in, come up with these recommendations, and Aung San Suu Kyi said that her government will implement these recommendations. And I think that is an entry point that we really want to look at and focus on, because the recommendations are good. How can we get the government to fulfill its promise to move forward on these recommendations, on implementing the recommendations? Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to take a question over there.
So my question is sort of a follow-up to whatever we've discussed so far. So first of all, when you have political parties that are fighting elections on, you know, nativist, nationalist, you know, of colors, that way, then how do you expect them to take, you know, foreign policy stances that are more humanitarian in nature? And if, you know, you have countries like the US, India, and a lot of, you know, countries even in the European Union that are moving towards that trend, how do you, you know, face an international crisis like this? That's one part. And the second thing is, you mentioned about the Kofi Annan Commission. If you could just shed some light on what would you say are the next possible steps that need to be taken by the government in Myanmar as well as the world community as a whole in that regard?
Do you want to speak first?
No,
or speak on last?
Sorry, because she talked about Kofi Annan before.
The first thing is for people, well, first of all, let me say there are three populations of Rohingya that we need to be thinking about. One is the people who are still in internally displaced camps in Rakhine State. Two is the people who are living in communities and with restricted mobility in Rakhine State. And three is the refugees. So the first thing is really to be able to start that process of people being able to come back if they want to come back, and if their safety can be guaranteed and they can actually put together a reasonable life in Rakhine State. So putting in place the conditions in Rakhine State